Hey there. Welcome to another exciting episode of the Dr. Gundry Podcast, the weekly podcast where I give you the tools you need to support your gut, boost your health, and live your youngest, healthiest life.
Each week, Dr. Stephen Gundry, a cardiologist, medical innovator, and author of New York Times bestsellers, The Plant Paradox and The Plant Paradox Cookbook, shares the latest in cutting-edge health information. He's excited to be a part of your unique health journey. So let's get started.
So before we get into this week's episode, let's take a look at our review of the week. I'm so excited about this podcast. Great job, Dr. G. Rock star you are. Well, thank you very much, Sovain. And I'm glad you're loving it. That's why we're doing it. I'll keep doing it. So if you want me to read your review, make sure to rate and review the Dr. Gundry Podcast on iTunes. Welcome to the Dr. Gundry Podcast. Today we are talking about fat, specifically the type of fat you should be eating for your health and longevity. And to join me today, we've got Dr. James Nicolantonio, boy, that's a good name, who actually is the co-author with a brand new book called Super Fuel. And he's the co-author with my good friend, Dr. Joseph Mercola. So welcome to the podcast today.
Thanks for having me.
So he's an internationally known and respected research scientist. He's actually spent a decade studying the effects of different fats on the body. And I might add, and I hope we'll get to it, the effect of salt on the body. So you talk about a couple of great controversial topics to have on the Gundry Podcast. I couldn't have picked a better author. So Superfuel talks about the ketogenic keys to unlock the secrets of good fats, bad fat, and great health. Okay, so come on now. Your body doesn't need fat. I mean, Dr. Esselstyn would tell you you don't need fat. Dr. T. Colin Campbell would tell you you don't need fat. Come on, Doc, what's the deal? Give me the straight.
Well, what's interesting is, you know, a lot of people that are doing the ketogenic diet actually think all fats are the same. Like, they don't really decipher really good fats from bad fats a lot of time. And so really the reason why I wrote this book was to really dive deep and try to understand, is there a difference between, let's say, the fat in an avocado or the fat in wild seafood, and let's say the fats in bacon or butter. And it turns out there is a big difference. And so, you know, really that's what the book is all about, trying to pick the healthiest foods that provide the fats to actually make you a better fat burning machine.
So you mean there is a difference? I shouldn't eat a stick of butter every day if I'm on a ketogenic diet? That's not good for me?
Correct. I mean, and I'm honestly an offender of that. Like, a few years ago, I was probably putting too much heavy cream in my coffee and I started gaining weight. And so that's when I realized I need to really research the different types of fats to see how they metabolize in your own body. So just take, for example, omega-3 fats. They actually increase your fat burning genes in the liver. So if you and I are sitting here and we're consuming 3 or 4 grams of omega-3s from, let's say, fish oil, or we're getting it from wild seafood, we are literally, our beta oxidation, our fat burning in the liver, is 20% higher. And if we're exercising, our beta oxidation in our liver or our fat burning goes up by 30% simply by consuming more omega-3s. And so it's almost like if you swap out and replace butter with omega-3s, it's almost like swapping out a V4 engine for a V8 engine. You are literally more efficient and better at burning fat. And so that's just one key that really Superfuel dives into.
So I'm glad you brought up omega-3s. You know, you mentioned salmon. So there's a lot of confusion, particularly I take care of a lot of vegan and vegetarian patients. And a ton of them use a lot of flaxseed oil because it is a short chain omega-3. And when I measure their omega-3 index, which looks at DHA and EPA, it's in the toilet. They have no DHA and EPA. So tell me a little bit about, so what's the difference between a short chain omega-3 and a long chain omega-3 and our health?
Right. So what you were referring to, what vegans and vegetarians are mostly consuming, is the plant omega-3, which is called alpha-linolenic acid. And so our bodies do have an ability to convert that to the longer chain, quote-unquote, marine omega-3s, EPA and DHA, but it's not very efficient at doing that. So to give you an example, only about, you know, 5 or 10% of the ALA that you're getting is going to convert to EPA, and only about 0.5% is going to convert to DHA. So unless you're a woman of childbearing age, you're not a good converter of these plant omega-3s to these marine omega-3s. And, you know, really DHA is one of the most important fats for the brain. I mean, every third fat in the brain is DHA, and it's important for eye health as well. And so if you're not consuming DHA, at least from an algae oil, so you can get it from, you know, a quote unquote vegetarian, vegan type of source, but it is missed. I'm glad you brought that up. That's an important fat that a lot of people aren't getting in their diet.
Yeah. And I have particularly my vegans take the algae DHA, and it's just great. But your point, I want to really stress, because I bring this up repeatedly in The Longevity Paradox, my new book, that our brain is anywhere from 60 to 70% fat. And of that fat, DHA is about half of that fat. And there's some beautiful studies in humans looking at MRIs of brain size and of the hippocampal size, the memory centers. And people who have the highest omega-3 index have the biggest brains and the largest memory centers. And people who have the lowest levels of DHA and EPA have the most shrunken brains and the smallest areas of memory. And that goes back, I'm old enough to remember that my mother said that fish was brain food. And so I would assume that you and Dr. Mercola would say the same thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when you think about it, we actually, through an evolutionary times, and I go through this in Superfuel, I was almost curious myself, DHA is so important, where would we have gotten it in Africa? Like, how did we obtain DHA? And in fact, because animals besides hyenas can get at the skull and the brain of their kills, we had access to this basically great source of DHA that no other animal besides a hyena could get to. And so there's sites in Africa over 2 million years ago where our ancient ancestors are literally just surrounded by cracked open skulls. And to give you an example of how high the DHA content is of brain, it's 30% more concentrated than salmon. And so we had this source of DHA for millions of years. And that's partly why it's so important for brain health and why we have so much of it in our brain, is we had a really good access to it, not just through seafood, but also through literally brain.
So you're not telling me to go eat some brains tonight?
No, I'm not. But it goes to the fact that your body has had access to this quote-unquote marine omega-3 for millions of years. And so we've evolved on actually adequate intakes, even when we aren't near a coastline.
Gotcha. Okay, so in general, these long-chain omega-3 fats, we can get from deep water fish, we can get from krill, and we can get from, you know, molecularly distilled fish oil. Everybody talks to me and they said, oh my gosh, you know, fish oil, there's tons of heavy metals in fish oil, and that's a dangerous thing. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think there is somewhat of a concern, not really with fish oil per se. A lot of it gets filtered out. I would say, though, wild seafood, you do need to make sure you're sourcing it correctly. I mean, there are clean waters in Canada, Alaska, New Zealand, and other areas, but there are obviously other areas that are much more contaminated. So kind of my philosophy is I eat wild seafood twice a week, and on days I'm not consuming wild seafood, the other days, I'm consuming high doses of krill oil to get that healthy astaxanthin, which is a healthy carotenoid, and as well as choline. It's very high in phosphatidylcholine, which is important for the brain. And then also I consume high doses of omega-3 fish oil. So I combine both of them. But you don't really need to worry about really heavy metals in fish oil. I mean, some fish oils you might need to worry about the oxidation products. So I keep my fish oil in the freezer to prevent it. A real true fish oil will not freeze in the freezer. And this is what the fish use in their cell membrane, so they don't freeze in cold water. People always get shocked at me, like, Dr. D, you put your fish oil in the freezer? Absolutely. It actually significantly reduces it from oxidizing. So I wouldn't really more worry about the contamination of fish oil. I do worry, though, a little bit more about the oxidation of it.
Okay, so we're gonna leave fish oil, but we gotta lay one to rest. So this past week, big study once again showed that fish oil is worthless for cardiovascular health, as well as vitamin D is worthless. What say you?
Okay, so that study was the Vital study, and they tested only 840 milligrams of EPA and DHA, which is a very low dose, so less than a gram of active omega-3s. And we had a study that came out on the same day. The full results came out of the Reduce-It study, where I've been publishing for a decade that they weren't giving a high dose of omega-3, but in Reduce-It, they finally gave 4 grams of EPA. And so the Reduce-It study did show a significant 25% reduction in cardiovascular events. And if you actually look at Vital, there was a significant benefit on the primary endpoint in those who consumed less than 1.5 fish meals per week. But people that were eating more than 1.5 fish meals per week, they didn't see that benefit. So that makes sense. If you're already consuming fish, adding a little bit of omega-3 fish oil isn't going to do any benefit. But if you aren't consuming a lot of fish per week, then you did. There was a significant, about 20% reduction in the primary endpoint and about a 50% reduction in heart attacks and death from heart attacks, which is very important.
Yeah, and I think that's really important. The devil is in the details. And, you know, those of us who write and review the literature, the abstract tells you one thing, but you got to get the paper and see what it actually says. And sensationalism works really good as headlines. So it's actually far more exciting to say fish oil doesn't work than to say fish oil is pretty good for you.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay, so we'll leave omega-3s. Let's talk about the other fat, omega-6. And everybody kind of hears, you got to have a balance of omega-3 and omega-6, or omega-6s are bad for you. Give me your take on omega-6s.
Yeah, I think if you're getting omega-6, or which is linoleic acid, is the parent omega-6, which gets eventually converted to arachidonic acid as it gets elongated in the body. If it's coming from whole foods, that's okay, because the whole food, like in a nut or a seed, is going to have a coating protecting that very unstable omega-6 fat from oxidizing in the acidity of your stomach. And it's going to have vitamin E to protect the linoleic acid or the omega-6 from oxidizing. So nature is very smart. It packages highly unstable fats, you know, in a seed or a nut or some other type of substance and puts vitamin E there. The problem is with these heart-healthy vegetable oils, they have been already oxidized because you can't just squeeze a cotton seed or you can't squeeze a soybean and you get a lot of oil out of it. It requires heavy machinery, hexane solvents, high heat. And so those vegetable oils that you're told to cook with, they're already oxidized before you even start cooking them in your pan. And then you start cooking these omega-6 heart healthy vegetable oils, you oxidize them further, you consume them in the gut, and your own acid starts oxidizing them. And then you absorb these omega-6 fats. And what's really, I think you'll really appreciate this. There was a study that showed if you give omega-6 to animals, it actually grows the bacteria that produces LPS. Whereas if you gave the animals omega-3, the bacteria that would thrive was bacteria that didn't produce LPS. So it almost goes to show you that this omega-3-6 balance is even controlling your gut microbiome, which when I read that, I was actually pretty shocked.
Yeah, there's actually some very interesting work. I talk about in the plant paradox that omega-3s, long-chain omega-3s, actually prevent LPSs from appearing in the bloodstream, partially because they change the gut microbiome. You're absolutely right. Yep. But what about the evil long-chain omega fat or arachidonic acid? What's your thought about it? Is it evil, or did it get a bad name? No.
It's not evil. I mean, your brain is also very highly saturated in arachidonic acid. The problem is that arachidonic acid is also very susceptible to oxidation. And so it gets a bad rap, I think, because of that. And also because, you know, animal foods have gotten a bad rap, which are high in arachidonic acid. And so as long as you can prevent arachidonic acid from metabolizing and forming its pro-inflammatory metabolites, which omega-3s do, then it's not an issue. But there are people with issues that are consuming the linoleic acid, creating oxidation in the body and actually oxidizing the arachidonic acid.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. It's actually the short chain omega-6 fats. They're actually right. The troublemaker that are potentiating arachidonic acid, which you're right, is the other important long chain fat in your brain. And there's actually a beautiful study out of the University of Texas giving athletes omega-6 fats as a supplement. And these guys actually had better athletic performance, but shockingly, their inflammation levels went down with the addition of these supplements. And so I think it's gotten a bad rap, quite honestly, as long as it comes in the whole package.
Okay? Yep.
All right, so now wait a minute, Dr. D. All these healthy vegetable oils, you don't mean canola oil as well. I mean, everybody knows how good that is for your heart.
Well, you know, in fact, canola oil is, you know, healthier than these heart healthy, you know, quote unquote, vegetable oils because it's higher in omega-3. But the problem is I still wouldn't consume it, and I certainly would never cook with it because, again, it's still an unstable polyunsaturated fat, meaning there's a bunch of double bonds that can oxidize in these fats, whereas animal fats are fully saturated. They don't have any double bonds that are susceptible to these free radical attacks. And so if you want to cook with an oil, canola is probably one of the worst. But what actually a lot of people don't realize is extra virgin olive oil is actually one of the best oils to cook with. And because it's so high in polyphenols, it completely prevents the oil from oxidizing, whereas canola has virtually zero polyphenols. And so if you're going to cook with a non-saturated fat like coconut oil or butter, which are stable fats, if you're going to cook with an unsaturated fat, it better have a ton of polyphenols in it, like extra virgin olive oil, or you're in big trouble.
Yeah, that's exactly right. In fact, there are actually very good published studies that olive oil withstands high heat, does not oxidize with high heat. And it's one of the hardest things I have to do to convince my patients that it's perfectly safe to cook with olive oil. Not only perfectly safe, but it's one of the better cooking oils.
It is. I mean, they literally just did a study comparing olive oil to not only coconut oil, which is one of the most highly saturated fats, 90% of it is saturated fat, coconut oil, but also avocado oil as well. And olive oil won. Extra virgin olive oil had the least oxidation products, even compared to coconut oil. So it is. I mean, even though it has a low smoke point, a lot of people get this confused. They get confused with smoke point and oxidation. And so just because something has a high smoke point like canola oil or grapeseed oil does not mean it's not going to oxidize.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, canola oil and grapeseed oil, people often hear the word grapeseed and they think of grapeseed extract, which is tons of polyphenols. But grapeseed oil is devoid of polyphenols. It's one of the worst.
Yes, it is. I mean, it's got an omega-6 to 3 ratio of like 700 to 1.
Yeah. It's nasty stuff. Okay, so when these oils oxidize, I tell people think of something going rancid or getting rusty. What effect do these oxidized oils have on us? Why don't we want that in us?
Yeah. Well, I think it's important to differentiate oxidation of omega-3 in your body versus omega-6. So actually, your body has to have a signal to tell itself that it's under attack and that it's being damaged. And the signal actually in most of our cells is DHA. So DHA is the alarm system. And so when DHA oxidizes from, you know, in your mitochondria, let's say your mitochondria are being attacked or you're having inflammation in the brain, when DHA oxidizes, it actually turns on the antioxidant response element. And that actually upregulates your own body's endogenous antioxidant systems. And so our bodies actually know what to do with oxidized omega-3. It's actually the alarm system to upregulate our own antioxidant system. Not so with omega-6. When omega-6 oxidizes, it forms what's called hydroperoxides and aldehydes. Basically, you don't really need to know what those are. Those are big words. But what they do is they cross-link proteins. Basically, they make your proteins not work anymore. Just like there's something called advanced glycation products when you cook, let's say, your meat and you form advanced glycation products where sugars bond to proteins. These fats, when they oxidize, particularly from omega-6, they basically form basically aggregates with your own proteins. So proteins in the brain, they can form neurofibrillary tangles. And so I honestly think that the oxidized omega-6s that people are consuming are it's literally one of the number one drivers of chronic disease, particularly brain diseases.
And that's all only happened in the last 50 years when we started eating heart healthy, right?
Right, exactly.
Okay. So you, I know, and Dr. McCall are big fans of a cyclic ketogenic diet, and the book is very good on doing that. Why not always be in ketosis? And maybe backing up a step, what the heck is ketosis and why do you want to be in that a good part of the time?
Yeah, well, I think we want to almost mimic what we did during evolutionary times. And, you know, really, if we were, you know, hunting for an animal and we couldn't catch it, well, we would be able to then just eat the plants around us. And so we were always somewhat consuming both animal and plant. And so we were getting some resistant starch, and so which is important. And so that feeds your gut bacteria. And so I think that if you're constantly in ketosis and you're never providing your healthy gut bugs the food that they need to thrive, and they produce their own fats that benefit you, these short-chain fatty acids, you know, butyric acid, and it has all these beneficial effects on your arteries and it helps grow colon health and the lining of your gut and all this. So if we are more gut genes and more bugs than we are humans, right? We also want to feed those guys too. So just strictly, you know, limiting carbs to a very, very low amount all the time, I don't think is really optimal for health.
So you're not a big fan of the carnivore diet?
Not in particular.
So describe to me and everybody who's watching or listening, what's a typical day like for you in terms of what you eat or even, you know, a week plan? I know you mentioned during the 2 days a week you're eating fish or wild shellfish. So give me a glimpse and what's a day in the life of Dr. D?
Well, I mean, on probably 2 or 3 days a week, I'll have a couple pastured eggs for breakfast. You know, I think it's important to get some type of source of choline. So that's a good source for me, as well as there's some obviously good healthy carotenoids and vitamins in pastured eggs and iodine and all that other good stuff. But like you said, wild seafood twice a week, usually wild salmon. On days that I'm not doing that, I make sure to do the omega-3 supplements that we talked about, krill and fish oil. And then, you know, I'll try to eat, if I can, you know, maybe 8 to 16 ounces of pastured meat. But it doesn't have to be. I know some people can't afford pastured meat or grass-fed meat. And that's okay as long as you're boosting your omega-3 content through either the wild seafood or the, you know, the supplements. You know, and besides that, you know, some vegetable, some type of resistant starch, cooked and cooled potato is usually what I go with to feed my healthy gut bacteria. Because when you cool a potato for 8 hours, you literally quadruple the starch or the resistant starch, excuse me. So it literally becomes less glucose and more fiber for your healthy gut bugs. So I try to integrate that, you know, three times a week. So those are just some of the foods that I pick.
So what I'm hearing is you're not consuming 10 tablespoons of coconut oil every day and another 5 tablespoons of MCT oil to achieve ketosis.
Correct. No, I'm trying to use real whole foods, nuts, seeds too, you know, every now and then. Spinach. I love green, healthy greens. That's how I try to get my healthy fats. It's really just through whole food.
Okay. So why, you know, Joe McCullough and I have talked about this. He, you know, to his credit, often goes all the way as deep as he can on a subject, and he tried to stay in ketosis constantly. And it clearly had some negative effects on him, as you know, as he found out, and I would have predicted. So, and it certainly goes against what we did evolutionary. We clearly were not in ketosis every day. So how do you advise people that you see, how do you strike a balance of going in and out of ketosis?
Yeah, well, I think a lot of people almost confuse ketosis with fat burning and fat loss. And so they're so worried about the number on the ketone, you know, on their ketone levels versus, you know, what's really going on with their own health. And so, you know, exercise is one of the best things to induce ketosis. And I think, you know, the cyclical ketogenic diet that we recommend in Superfuel is more so upping carbohydrate and protein intake on days you work out. And really that makes sense because carbs are going to increase insulin, which is going to help you grow more muscle when you're working out. So I think a cyclical type of ketogenic diet where you're integrating more carbs and protein on days you're working out, just it makes more sense.
Okay. So let me, in the interest of your time and my time, kind of switch thoughts on salt. And you're the author of The Salt Fix. And I, you know, as a cardiologist and a heart surgeon, I'm constantly bumping up against my colleagues who have taken away all the salt from all of my patients, and they're on 3 or 4 hypertension drugs. And the first thing I do is basically hand them back their iodized sea salt shaker, and they, you know, get this look in their eyes of, you know, terror. And am I doing them a disservice? How come?
Right. Well, I mean, you bring up a good point. I mean, most people view salt as like almost like a poison rather than an essential mineral. And we've been demonized. I mean, the first thing you do, if you go to a doctor's office and they take your blood pressure and it's slightly elevated, the first thing they're going to tell you is to cut your salt intake, right? Like, right. As if everybody should be on a low salt diet. But the problem is there's nuance to everything, right? And so when you think about that, low sodium levels in the blood are literally the most common electrolyte abnormality in the United States. Over 6 million people have low sodium levels in the blood. And then you start looking at things that cause salt loss. So in the book, I really started going through, well, if we didn't get a ton of salt or added salt during evolutionary times, why do we need so much nowadays? And that was kind of like the question I wanted to answer. And caffeine or coffee is one of the greatest salt depleters that you can have. And I mean, everybody's jacked up on a cup of Joe nowadays. And if you think about it,
wait a minute, say that again. Caffeine makes you lose salt?
Yeah. Oh, not man. Just water. Not, it doesn't just diurese you, but you lose a ton of sodium and chloride. And so if you consume just 4 cups of coffee, you're going to lose about 1/2 teaspoon of salt. And then you think about exercise. The average person loses another 1/2 teaspoon of salt per hour of exercise. So the American Heart Association tells you to exercise 60 minutes a day, which is going to cause you to lose 1/2 teaspoon of salt, but they tell you to eat less than 1/2 teaspoon of salt. So right away, they're contradicting themselves. And there's many medications, as you said, people are on now. The average adult is on 4 chronic medications. Most of those are going to be diuretics, diabetic medications, and almost every single one of those are going to cause salt loss. So if, I mean, there's so many people, as soon as they start bringing back healthy salts into their diet, they just feel way better. They don't get the dizziness from going to from a seated to a standing position. Their exercise routine is phenomenally better. And so, but they've been scared again that salt is bad, and it's absolutely not.
And a point you bring up, I think, is fascinating. You say that salt will actually reduce your carbohydrate cravings. Am I paraphrasing that correctly?
Yeah, you nailed it. Yeah.
And so wait a minute. So I'll put some salt in my coffee from now on, and then I won't have to have my donut?
Exactly. There you go.
Wow, fantastic. Okay. Yeah, so it's really interesting. Some of these myths get perpetrated without a whole lot of scientific rigor. And yep. You're right. I mean, for instance, in Palm Springs, if we're playing tennis in the summer, if we're not taking salt tablets, we are going to end up on the ground on the tennis court. And, yeah. So anybody who wants to eat salt, just move to Palm Springs and you can have all the salt you want.
There you go.
Not too much of a problem in Rochester in the winter, though.
No.
All right. So you and Dr. McCullough are certainly controversial in saying you ought to eat all these fats, saturated fats are good for you, avoid these healthy oils. What do you say to your critics?
Yeah, I mean, so I've published numerous papers on this topic. And so really the reason why people are so confused is because evidence was buried and has only recently surfaced in the last few years. So the researchers that, let's say one study that just resurfaced from the basement 30 years ago, the results were never published. It was called the Minnesota Coronary Survey. And they looked at thousands of patients and they swapped out animal fats for these vegetable soybean oils. And they didn't get the results they wanted. So they buried them in a basement for 30 years. And luckily they resurfaced. And now we know from that study that these heart healthy vegetable oils actually significantly increased heart attacks upon autopsy. And same with another study called the Sydney Diet Heart Study. Again, there was some data that was buried in that study and that showed the same results. There was increases in death when people switched from animal fat to the high omega-6 fats, a significant increase. So we have the study showing now that they're not heart healthy. They're actually worse than animal fat.
And does it matter what kind of animal fat you're eating? Is it okay to go just get a prime steak that's marbled with fat? Okay, how come? That's an animal fat. Come on.
Yeah. So, you're right. So a lot of people are kind of, especially carnivore, let's say, they're going through Wendy's drive-thru and eating patties and thinking like that's healthy for them, right? The problem is those patties are probably deep fried in vegetable oils. And they're sourced from an animal that's being fed grain. So it's high in omega-6, low in omega-3. And part of the benefit of this grass-fed meat is, again, these animals are eating grass. So they're getting vitamin E and beta carotene. And you can literally look at the fat and it'll have like a yellowish, orangish hue to it from the beta carotene. So the fats from Wendy's burgers versus the fats from a grass-fed beef are much different. And so there is the nuance, again, we don't want to lose that in the narrative. There is a difference between where you're actually sourcing those animal fats.
Yeah, that's a great point. I've got a good friend, Jimmy Schmidt, who's won 3 James Beard Awards, and he actually has a bunch of Wagyu beef that's pasture-raised, grass-fed, grass-finished, and the oil he actually gets from those animals is golden color, and he calls it golden oil. And that's all the carotenoids that are in that oil. I mean, it's gold. I mean, really intensely gold, and it's obviously very flavorful. So, if a great chef understands this, who are we to question that, right?
Yep.
All right. So, let me just go to that point one more time. So, what do you say to Dr. Esselstyn when he says, animal fat is the root of all evil, or any fat is the root of all evil? Do you say, he's got some very good results that I respect. Is he just wrong, or is that a good difference of opinion?
Yeah, I don't think he's entirely wrong. If you eat bad fats, they're going to be bad for you, right? Just like if you eat a bad carb, that's going to be bad for you as well. So you can do both bad. You can do a plant-based diet bad, and you can do a carnivore or a high-fat diet bad. And that's really what Superfuel is about, picking and selecting the healthy fats from whole foods versus, like you said, just chugging butter or chugging down heavy cream and thinking that's healthy for you.
Yeah, I think that's a great, great explanation of what we're all talking about. Yeah, I've seen some really bad vegan diets, and I've actually seen some excellent vegan diets. Same way, I've seen some really good high-fat diets, and I've seen most of them are disastrous high-fat diets.
Yeah.
So I think if we all just kind of backed up a little bit and said, you know, and I talk about that in The Plant Paradox, and I think there's a lot of good things to recommend that we need to pick from everybody's ideas. All right.
Got it.
So before we go, on this podcast, I always answer an audience question, and we may put you in on this one as well. So bear with me for a second. So Gail sends this question in from Twitter. Dr. Gundry, I have been on The Plant Paradox and feel great. Well, thanks, Gail. I appreciate hearing that. Can you tell me how I can lose weight while on your plan? I have not lost weight on The Plant Paradox, and I would like to while on the plan. Well, Gail, quite frankly, your comment is pretty unusual for people on The Plant Paradox program. The major complaint, if there is one, is they can't keep weight on them. It keeps getting lower and lower. And that's actually one of my biggest questions. When I see people in my office who they're clearly following the program, all their blood markers are good, their inflammation is gone, the one thing that seems to be the common factor in people who aren't losing weight is they're eating a lot of resistant starches, or they're eating a lot of fruit. And unfortunately, as fond as I am of resistant starches for our gut microbiome, there is a limit. For instance, I'll give you an example. One of my patients was having plantain pancakes 3 times a day, every day, and couldn't understand why he wasn't losing weight in addition to the other foods he was eating. And when we reduced his plantain pancakes to things he was going to eat on the weekend, the weight started falling off. I've had people that eat 2 or 3 sweet potatoes every day, and when we back them off to a more reasonable amount. So, Dr. D, what do you think? Can we eat too many resistant starches?
I think yes, but I probably bet you that a lot of those people eating the sweet potatoes were overcooking and not cooling them. I do think if you undercook a potato and you cool it, it is very difficult to gain weight on those type of potatoes because those are just gigantic fiber bombs. But I do agree. If you're just eating 3 sweet potatoes every day and you're not undercooking those and you're not cooling those before you eat them, absolutely.
Yeah, that's a great point. And again, thank you, Gail, for asking. A lot of people that I see, and I've made this mistake myself, you know, I want a sweet potato, and I forget, and I come home and I throw it in the oven or I throw it in the pressure cooker, and then I'm ready to eat. And I don't go to the trouble of throwing it in the refrigerator, and I don't think often enough to have a bunch sitting in my refrigerator to reheat. So, and a lot of people, you're right, make the mistake of not cooling, whether it's the basmati rice, whether it's the sweet potato, whether it's the Jerusalem artichokes, not cooling them down and then reheating them or eating them cold. Yeah, great point. So I'm glad you're on. And Gail, thanks for answering that. Okay, so Dr. D, thanks for being on the podcast. Where can they find you and your book, Superfuel?
DrJamesDenick.com. I just launched that website. And so they can go and get Superfuel and the Salt Fix on Amazon. That's probably the easiest place to get it.
Okay. And this is out now. It just came out a few days ago, right?
Yeah, that's right.
All right. So I've read this book. I actually made a recommendation for the book. It's on the back if you care to read it. It's a great book. It's a very insightful. So find Superfuel and read it. So, Dr. Deet, thanks again for coming on the program. And everybody watching and listening, this is Dr. Gundry, and I'm always looking out for you. We'll see you next week. So for more information about this week's episode, please take a look at my show notes below and on drgundry.com. In the show notes, you'll also find a survey, and I'd love to find out more about you. Please take a few minutes to fill it out so I can do my best to provide information you're looking for. Thanks for listening to this week's episode of the Dr. Gundry Podcast. Check back next week for another exciting episode. And make sure to subscribe, rate, and review to stay up to date with the latest episodes. Head to drgundry.com for show notes and more information. Until next time, I'm Dr. Gundry, and I'm always looking out for you.